Okay, what we were was mentioning that that Arjuna's acceptance of Kshatriya Dharma is more or less to be taken like an example. He had the nature of Kshatriya, and therefore at the end of the Bhagavad Gita he took up his activity as a Kshatriya. But that is simply an indication that we should carry out our material duties according to our Swadharma. Bhaktivinoda also makes the point that Uddhava listened to Krishna's instructions in the Bhagavatam. Just as Bhagavad Gita appears in the Mahabharata, there is a set of instructions given by Krishna to Uddhava prior to Krishna's departure in the 11th canto of the Srimad Bhagavatam. That section is known as Uddhava Gita. So this is Bhagavad Gita, so Uddhava Gita. And now Uddhava is a Brahmana. Right. Within the pastimes of the Lord, he appears as a Brahmana. Within the pastimes of the Lord, Arjuna appears as a Kshatriya. So at the end of listening to Uddhava Gita, Uddhava, he accepts Sanya, non sort of life, Parivrajya. At the end of listening to Bhagavad Gita, Arjuna engages in his duty as a Kshatriya. At the end of Uddhava Gita, Uddhava takes to Brahmanical duty. Because Brahmanas are qualified to accept Parivrajya, sannyas. Non-Brahmanas are not eligible for sannyas. They can go up to Vanaprastha. Kshatriyas can go up to Vanaprastha. So that also should be understood as simply as an example. But while carrying out one's material duties corresponding to Varna and Ashram, one has to engage in spiritual progress. Then Bhaktivinoda raises a question. Arjuna is an exalted, supremely pure Vaishnava. Does he not have the nature of a Brahmana? Or not pure Vaishnavas automatically Brahmanas? So he says that definitely Arjuna is a person, is a devotee, directly, is a soul who is directly in touch with the Supreme Lord. But within the pastimes of the Lord in this world, in order to nourish the Lord's pastimes, he has accepted the swabhava or the nature of a Kshatriya. So therefore his nature at that time is corresponding to a Kshatriya, and therefore Arjuna he acts like a Kshatriya. Then Bhaktivinoda he points out that even though the Vedas seem to be saying so many different giving various different directions. You engage in Ashtanga Yoga, you engage in renunciation, you do some pious activity, you do some charity, you do some austerity. So many things are being promoted. Some of them say that you should worship the Supreme Lord. Some say that you should engage in atonement, prayaschitta. He says that that at a certain point, the great sages, they concluded that you can simply reorganize all of them under three headings. And the three headings are karma, jnana, and bhakti.
Karma, jnana, and bhakti.
But karma is material activity. Or you can, if you want to define it in a different way, you can take karma to be any activity. But generally, karma refers to material activities or activities which produce fruit within material existence. Like the typical example is you perform certain pious activities by which you can go to the heavenly planets. Heavenly planets is something like the standard example, and within Vedic civilization, a decent materialist at least wants to go to the heavenly planets. They don't want to be, they consider this human earthly existence to be something like a slum. So they don't feel like being here. Somehow you're here, but at least you should move up, at least to the heavenly plans. This is how a Vedic materialist tends to think. At least you move up, you move up. So,
Swarga Prapti
is considered the phala, the fruit of as a standard example of pious activities. But you see, attainment of the heavenly plans is also material. So karma leads to results within the material sphere. So this is one large category of Vedic injunctions. Then you have jnana. Jnana refers to getting out of material existence. The idea that is associated with the concept of karma is bhukti.
Bhukti. Karma is associated with bhukti. Jnana is associated with mukti. Bhakti is associated with prema. Bhagavat prema.
So karma is associated with the concept of bhukti, material enjoyment. Jnana is associated with the concept of mukti, which is cessation of material existence. You're moving out. You're getting out of material existence. You're getting out of the miseries of material existence. Whereas bhakti is a pure spiritual activity. Bhakti is what the living entities do in the spiritual world. That is pure spiritual activity. So automatically within, and the fruit of bhakti is bhakti itself, in the sense of prema bhakti. Prema bhakti means selfless, loving devotional service to Supreme Lord in the spiritual world, or in one's swarup. In one's swarup. So now there are different types of karma. Bhaktivinoda Thakur points out that every activity, prescribed material activity, they seem to have an immediate fruit. The immediate fruit, for instance, he gives the example that one who gets, for instance, marriage. The immediate fruit of marriage is having children. But further, the next fruit of it is enjoyment of family life. But he says, if you carefully analyze, the Vedas don't prescribe ultimately that you just get stuck with sense enjoyment, because sense enjoyment is accompanied by misery. Inevitably, it's accompanied by misery. Now, even in the 11th canto, when Lord Krishna is explaining, he's analyzing the Vedas to Uddhava, he makes this point that, look, the Vedas are not interested in putting any living entity in misery. So why would they recommend living entities to engage in sense enjoyment? Because sense enjoyment is always accompanied by sense suffering. So the real motive, Bhaktivinoda Thakur, he says, the real motive that behind the prescription of the of karma in the Veda is shanti, peace. They want to bring you to a platform where you can feel peace. So that is what is the actual fruit of karma. There are various types of activities. There are bodily activities, there are mental activities, there are activities in relationship to community, and of course there are spiritual activities. Very different types of activities. Similarly, it is with jnana. Now, jnana refers to the tendency to know and understand things. Vichara, the tendency to deliberate, to think. This is called jnana. And this is, Bhaktivinoda says, that this is natural for the soul. The soul naturally thinks. soul experiences, the soul also deliberates. These are two features of the soul. In his Tattva Sutra, Bhakti Vinod Thakur, he explains this point. That the soul has the tendency to perform activities and seek happiness, but the soul also has the tendency to think and deliberate. Activities are for the sake of experiencing happiness in personal relationships. Vichara ragau chetana dharmau swarupa pravrittitvat. In Tattva Sutra he writes that the soul has two features. One is vichara, to deliberate, to think. Is this right? Is this wrong? What is the meaning of this? What is this that I am perceiving? And so on. The other is love, which is personal relationships, which naturally involves activities. You cannot love without engaging in a certain sort of activity with other living beings who act according to their own will. Love means you can only have love between two individuals who think independently. You cannot love your reflection, for instance, in reality. You can imagine that you love, nor can you in reality love a doll. In reality, you can only love someone else who's alive. And there are activities. So one is activity and the other is vichar, deliberation. And Bhaktivinoda points out there are four types of deliberations, jnanalochana. One is jadiya jnanalochana. One is to try to understand matter, gross matter, sense objects, gross matter. The other is laingik jnanalochana, by which he means you are contemplating on subtle things, on the mind, on the mental plane. That is also like, for instance, psychology. You're trying to understand somebody else's mind. Physics is you're trying to understand matter. But then you also try to understand the mind. So one type of knowledge is knowledge of gross matter. Another is knowledge of subtle matter. Then the third one, he says, is jada o lingir vyatirek jnanalochana. That knowledge of or analysis of or perceiving that which exists beyond gross and subtle matter. Like, for instance, the souls in the, for instance, the impersonalists who have attained perfection, prapta sayujya, those who attain perfection of impersonal existence, that sort of perfection. They are only aware that they exist. This is Brahman realization, impersonal Brahman realization. This is also perception, this is also knowledge, this is also realization. Definitely there is consciousness, conscious. And then he says, Shuddha Jnanalochana. And then there is pure, the soul's pure consciousness, pure perception, pure awareness. Now, the souls in Vaikuntha, in Goloka Vrindavan, etc., they are also seeing Krishna. They are also seeing the spiritual abode, they are seeing other living entities, they are acting, they are performing various activities. So they also see. So that is the actual nature of the soul. The soul is actually seeing what it is meant to see. The soul is put in its right place. The soul is the spiritual world are also acting. So they are engaged in pure activity. And they have pure perception. So ultimately, Bhaktivinoda Thakur says, it is bhakti which is the highest type of karma, the highest type of jnana, simultaneously. It is possible for one entity to have two features which are very different. Like you may ask, how can bhakti have both the nature of karma, an activity, and how can it also be of the nature of conscious perception? Like Prabhupada referred to love of God as Krishna consciousness. Krishna consciousness. And he said this is based on a statement by Rupa Goswami and also a statement by Vishwanath Chakravarti. Krishna Bhavanamrita. Prabhupada gave this as the Bengali equivalent, the Sanskrit equivalent of Krishna consciousness. Bhavana, perception. Krishna Bhavana. Krishna Bhavana Amrita. The immortal perception of Krishna. The imperishable perception of Krishna. The nectarian perception of Krishna. So this is Krishna consciousness. But how can bhakti, which is an activity, simultaneously be a conscious perception? We can understand even in our day-to-day experience. Sometimes you look at a certain item, like it can have two properties simultaneously. Like for instance, you can have lemon rice. It has one property of yellow color. It has a certain taste. It has a certain texture. So it has three different properties simultaneously. And each of them are perceived differently. The color is seen by the eye. The taste is felt by the tongue. And the texture is felt by the fingers, skin. Similarly, the activity of the pure soul in the spiritual world can be analyzed in different ways. One way of analysis is analysis of what they perceive. Another way of analysis is what they do. So simultaneously, bhakti has this double nature. It is the highest type of karma and it is pure. It is the highest type of jnana also, and that is also pure. Now, at this point, Bhaktivinoda begins to discuss Jnana Mishra Bhakti and Karma Mishra Bhakti. These are all important concepts which Vishwanatha Chakravarti Thakur also brings up. I'll bring it out when I am dealing with Vishwanatha Chakravarti's introduction. So I'll skip that for time being here. But he points out that Bhakti in its pure state is called Prema Bhakti. It is also called Kevala Bhakti, exclusive Bhakti. It is called Akinchana Bhakti, spotless Bhakti. Literally Akinchana Bhakti means Bhakti without anything else. Ananya Bhakti is Bhakti without anything else. Akinchana Bhakti, Amala Bhakti, Shuddha Bhakti. So ultimately Shuddha Bhakti will turn out to be Prema Bhakti. If we are engaged in Shuddha Bhakti now, then it will automatically over time it will become Prema Bhakti. If I do not engage in Shuddha Bhakti now, it is not going to automatically become Prema Bhakti. Shuddha Bhakti is considered at the initial stage, Shuddha Bhakti is considered to be like a green mango, which if you just give time, it will become yellow mango, a ripe mango. But you have to be engaged in Shuddha Bhakti. Do not engage in Shuddha Bhakti, it will not automatically transform into Prema Bhakti. That's an important point. Okay, now this scripture, Bhagavad Gita, it has 18 chapters. In the first 6 chapters, primarily karma is brought up. Vedic material activities and how it should be performed. If you perform it in a certain manner, it becomes helpful for bhakti. In the middle 6 chapters, bhakti, the activities of bhakti are prescribed. In the last 6 chapters, jnana is prescribed. But ultimately, bhakti is accepted as the highest means. Also, karma will not yield any fruit unless it's mixed with bhakti. Jnana will not yield any fruit until it's mixed with bhakti. The idea is, for instance, let us say someone gets married. The act of marriage by itself is just mundane. It is karma. Having a girlfriend is sinful. Getting married is pious. So a pious activity is called karma. But that is just a material activity. And therefore Vaishnavas don't just get married. They prefer to marry a practicing devotee. Because in that way you are mixing karma with bhakti. If you live with a Vaishnava, that is considered to be Vaishnava Sangha, which is an element of bhakti. So you perform activities in such a way that you are simultaneously doing pious activity, but you are also doing devotional activities. Pious activities are not by themselves devotional activities. You have to mix it. You have to mix it. So that is the technique that one can learn from the Vaishnavas. Similarly, Prabhupada said that if you are a householder and you are earning money, you donate some money for the propagation of Krishna consciousness, because then you are mixing. You are mixing. Giving money for propagation of Krishna Bhakti is an element of Krishna Bhakti. Pranayara se dhya vacha. That you can give your life, or you give money, or you give your mind and intelligence, or you give your speech in the propaganda of Krishna consciousness. So at least you give money to something. Now that is an element of Bhakti. Just earning for your family, that is karma. At least you are maintaining your family, kutumba poshana, that is karma. That is a pious activity. If you don't even maintain your family, it is sinful. So at least you are maintaining family, that's pious, that is karma. Sinful activities are called vikarma. Pious activities are called karma. Karma can be mixed with bhakti. Now you cannot mix sinful activities with bhakti. You cannot mix sinful activities with bhakti. Pious activities can be mixed with bhakti. And when we do that in a certain way, then those pious activities can not disturb our spiritual progress. They will not disturb our spiritual progress. So then that would be acceptable. Similarly, the tendency to acquire knowledge and understand and contemplate and try to understand the meaning of things. If you use the Vedic system, it is called jnana. If you don't use the Vedic system, if you don't study the scriptures and you directly try to understand the nature of this world and God, that is ajnana. You can mix jnana with devotional service. You cannot mix ajnana with devotional service. So what goes on in the universities and in the academic world, that is ajnana. That is not jnana. Whereas when you study the scriptures, that is jnana. But again, that's a process, how you do it, just like pious activities, getting married, having children, taking care of a wife. That's a system how you do it, and that's outlined in the Vedas, and that is taught through the disciplined line by the Acharyas. Similarly, if you want to analyze and understand the nature of this world and the nature of devotional service, etc., that can be accepted as jnana, provided you follow the system that's outlined in scripture and as taught by the Acharyas in the disciplined line. So karma can be mixed with bhakti, jnana can be mixed with bhakti. Vikarma cannot be mixed with bhakti, ajnana cannot be mixed with bhakti. But then there is something called shuddha bhakti, pure bhakti. When one engages in shuddha bhakti on the plane of love of God, then he does not even need the shastra charsha. He does not even need to analyze the scriptures. Because the soul directly sees. The soul is directly able to see. Scriptural knowledge, which is called jnana, is technically called paroksha jnana. Let me write this.
You should understand this concept. Paroksha jnana. Whereas, when we attain love of God, the direct experience
of God that we will have, that is called aparoksha jnana. These two statements, paroksha jnana and aparoksha jnana, are brought out by Baladeva Vidya Bhushan's spiritual master Radha Damodar in one important small book called Vedanta Syamantaka. There he brings out this paroksha jnana and aparoksha jnana. What in Gaudiya Vaishnava circles we generally refer to as jnana is paroksha jnana. That means it is shastriya jnana. It is shastra charcha. It is to study and it is the knowledge which is Shastragata, which is derived from scriptures by study. Just like blind people, they also can read books which are printed in braille. You know, there's braille. Their paper is all printed with this. Yeah. So they print it in a certain way. So they touch and they understand. So even so, they are touching, but the same book may be printed normal. Let us say you have a braille version of Bhagavad Gita, and you have a regular version of Bhagavad Gita, and you have one blind person, and you have a non-blind person. The non-blind person is seeing the Bhagavad Gita, and he's reading. The blind person is touching the Bhagavad Gita and he's reading. But one is indirect and one is direct. You're directly seeing. This one is not directly seeing. But I'll give another example. Just like, for instance, people who are born blind, they may be staying in their house since their childhood. And let us say they live in the same house. Since their childhood they've been living. So they know how to walk from the main entrance to the hall, to the bathroom, to the top floor, to the garden. They know. How do they know? They've never seen. Since birth they are blind. Ajanma antha. So how do they know? They know because they know how many steps to walk. You walk, you know, 5 steps like this, and then you turn right and you walk 2 steps, and that is where the bookshelf is. So they know. But then you may also have people who are not blind living in the same house. They also know. But their knowledge is direct. Whereas the blind person's knowledge is indirect. So that is like the difference between knowledge through scripture while we are in the conditioned status, and in the liberated status, they directly perceive whatever is stated in Shastra. The soul directly sees it. Jnana Suryasya Rashmayaha Hi Shastrani. Bhaktivinoda Thakur writes in Tattva Sutra that if you consider knowledge, scriptural knowledge, to be a sun, then the scriptures are like the rays of that sun. So just like when the sun is up, we can directly see things. Similarly, a liberated soul, Mukta Purusha, one who has attained love for Krishna, is directly able to see what is stated in the Shastra. He does not need to read to know it. Just like a person who is not blind and living in a house, he knows how to go to that bathroom. If you ask him, can you count how many steps is it from here to there? You say, that I don't know. I don't need to know. Similarly, if you go to some liberated soul, he doesn't need to know the shloka that describes this and that, because he's directly able to see how Maya works. He's able to see Krishna, he's able to see Maya, like Vyasadeva. And in the 7th chapter of the 1st canto, he engaged in meditation under the instruction of Narad Muni, and he directly saw how material nature works. He saw Maya, he saw Krishna, he saw the living entities being bewildered. He actually saw it. Now we are not able to see it because we are under Maya's influence, so we only see through these eyes and so on. But Vyasadeva was able to see it. Similarly, a liberated soul is able to see, is actually able to see. So that is called aparoksha jnana, non-indirect knowledge means direct knowledge. So that is aparoksha jnana. And one who has love of Krishna, he is able to perceive like that. But otherwise it is called paroksha jnana. Paroksha jnana has a place. We are right now conditioned. So right now we need to take help from Bhagavad Gita, Bhagavatam, Chaitanya Charitamrita and read. I cannot say, well, you know, I felt that this is the truth. How do we know what our feelings are? Our feelings may be totally bogus. It may be speculated by our brain, by our mind. It may not be reality. So it is better at our stage that we listen to the scriptures as far as jnana goes. And as far as our desires for material happiness goes, we allow ourselves to be restricted by pious activities. And we engage in bhakti, sadhana bhakti. we move ahead in sadhana bhakti. The highest instruction of Bhagavad Gita is Siddha Bhakti. Sarvadharman parityajya mamekam sharanam vraja aham tvam sarva papebhyo mokshayishyami maam. Bhagavad also writes, he says that there have been several commentaries on Bhagavad Gita, but most of them are presenting impersonal monism. And he says that Shankaracharya's commentary with Anandagiri's sub-commentary has been very famous. And he says that even though Sridhar Swami is not presenting impersonal monism, nevertheless he is presenting the Shuddha Dvaita Sampradaya's idea. And then he quotes another big name, one big name in the Mayavadi circles, Madhusudan Saraswati. Madhusudan Saraswati, he writes many things which apparently promote bhakti. And he wrote a commentary on the Gita which was quite popular, Gudartha Deepika. But Bhaktivinoda says, Charamopadesh Sale Sairu Kallana Pradhanaya. That his final analysis is analysis of the final portion of Bhagavad Gita. It doesn't produce auspiciousness. Because Madhusudan Saraswati says at the very end that ultimately it's all one. And this is the highest realization. Even the gopis, they realize that they are Krishna. And at the Rasa Leela, some gopis were imitating Krishna and they said, I am Krishna. And one gopi became Kaliya, another gopi became Krishna and danced. So he quotes these things and says, see, highest realization is that you are God. So even though bhakti is the greatest sadhana, ultimately you are God. So Madhusudan Saraswati's analysis in the last minute he cops out. Last minute he blurts. Then he says, Bhaktivinoda Thakur says that Sri Ramanuja Swami has written a commentary which is completely in line with devotional service. But in our place, which refers to Bengal, Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's Achitya Bheda Bheda has not been presented in any of the commentaries on Bhagavad Gita. And therefore for those devotees who relish such pure love of God, it does not increase their happiness. And he says, therefore, with great effort, I have endeavored to publish Vishwanath Chakravarti's commentary, and I have produced a Bengali paraphrase, a Bengali translation, called Rasika Ranjan. He says that Sri Mahaprabhu, Mahaprabhu's follower, Baladev Vidya Bhushan, has also presented a commentary on the Gita, but Baladev's commentary is quite philosophical, analytical, vicharpa. But Chakravarti's commentary is both analytical and it is filled with the mellows of devotion, Preeti Ras. And he says, therefore I am presenting Chakravarti's commentary. And more than that, Chakravarti's commentary on Bhagavatam is very famous in all places. And he says that Chakravarti's language is also simple, and therefore I have presented this. Okay. Any questions so far? Otherwise, I'll.
This paroksha is direct and aparoksha.
Paroksha is indirect. Aparoksha is non-indirect.
Paroksha is indirect.
Yeah. Even in Bengali, paroksha means indirect.
Non-indirect,
which means direct.
Yes, direct. And at one stage you mentioned about Swadharma.
Yeah.
I mean, I have seen argument about this in Canada when they conflict with the Bhakti. For example, the housewife has to prepare children for going to school, prepare breakfast and all that. Versus she wants to go from Mangala in the morning program. And if she goes for Mangala Arati in the morning program, she may not be able to do the housework.
Yeah.
And if she does the housework, she cannot go for the worship.
So things have to be adjusted in such a way that both Swadharma is carried out to whatever extent is required, and one spiritual dharma is also carried out. Both have to be adjusted. That's why you need a spiritual master who tells you. You need a spiritual master, and you need some Vaishnava who's locally, who's also competent, but who's well experienced with the local situation and the history of those particular devotees, understands their difficulties, understands their potentials, and gives a suitable help. It's like you need a doctor who knows your medical history, who knows your habits, and who knows you for quite some time to be able to give you competent medical advice. You can't just call up some doctor through the internet and say, hey, you know, because he's going to tell you based on whatever you tell him. You may not tell everything that's required for him to give you competent medical advice. That's how you set it. But it has to be worked out because Swadharma is required for a decent material upkeep. Just like we need to take care of our body. If we don't take care of our body, we fall sick. When we fall sick, we can't do devotional service properly. Even though it is a fact that Krishna consciousness should be practiced with such seriousness that we don't care whether we are dead or alive and sick and unhealthy. But most of us are very much affected by the body. Very much affected by the body. So therefore it is useful to take care of the body in such a way that we are able to execute Krishna consciousness. But it's a separate track. It is not that doing one's Swadharma is spiritual. Not doing Swadharma is spiritual. It's like taking care of the body and keeping it healthy. By itself it has no meaning. By itself it doesn't mean that I am very Krishna conscious. It simply means I am keeping my body materially fit enough in order to do Krishna consciousness. But I should do Krishna consciousness. And I can do Krishna consciousness even when I am sick also. So corresponding to one's level, one is given instruction by one's spiritual masters. So that's how it is done. Okay, here is Vishwanath Chakravarti. Iha khalu sakala shastrabhimata shrimat charana saroja bhajanaha swayam bhagavan arakriti parabrahma vasudeva sunu shri vasudeva sunu sakshat shri gopala puryam avatirya apara paramat atarkya svakripa shatyaiva prapanjika sakala loka lochana gochari kriptaha भवाब्दीन निमज्जमानान जगज्जनान उद्धृत्य स्वसौंदर्य माधुर्य आस्वादनया स्वीय प्रेम महाम्बुधौ निमज्जयामास. The Supreme Personality of Godhead, whose lotus feet are worshipped by all the scriptures, or devotion service to his lotus feet is presented by all the scriptures, that Supreme Lord, the absolute truth in the form of human-like being, the son of Vasudeva, he directly appeared in Sri Gopalapuri, Mathura. And by his excessive and inconceivable mercy and potency, he became visible to the eyes of the people of this world. Same point that Ramanujacharya had made. Having delivered the people of this world who were drowning in the ocean of material existence, he drowned them in the great ocean of love for him by making them relish his beauty and his sweetness. Shishta raksha dushta nigraha vratan nishtha mahishta pratishtopi bhuvaha bhara dukha pahara mishena dushtanaapi svadveshtrinaapi mahasamsara graha grasi bhutanaapi muktidana lakshanam parama rakshanam eva kritva स्वान्तर्धानोत्तरकालजनिष्यमान अनाद्य विद्याबंध निबंधन शोकमोहा व्याकुलान जीवान उद्धर्तुम शास्त्रकृन् मुनिगण गीयमान यशस्य धर्तुम स्वप्रिय सखम तादृश स्वेच्छा वशादेव रणमूर्धन युद्भूत शोकमोहम श्रीमदर्जुनम लक्षीकृत्य कांड त्रितयात्मक सर्ववेद तात्पर्य पर्यवसितार्थ रत्नालंकृतम श्री गीता शास्त्रम अष्टादशाध्यायम् अंतर्भूताष्टादश विद्यम साक्षात् विद्यमानीकृतमिव परम पुरुषार्थम आविर्भावायां बभूव. He says that even though he is fixed in the vow of protecting the civilized means followers of the Vedas, and destroying the uncivilized means those who, not just uncivilized, dushta, the wicked means those who disturb Vedic civilization. Vedic civilization is like a school which prepares you to go off. So if somebody comes and tries to stop a school from functioning, so that's called wicked. So even though he's fixed in that, and he is greatly renowned for that, still, despite that, you see, his Krishna's vow is to protect the civilized and to destroy the wicked. But when he appeared on this world, on the pretext of removing the burden of this world, he protected the wicked. How did he protect the wicked? Not only protect, he gave them supreme protection. He gave them supreme protection by giving them liberation. He caught those wicked souls who were personally inimical to him and who are being swallowed by the crocodile of great material existence, and he delivered them from material existence. So even though he is taken a vow to destroy the wicked, when he appeared in his original form, he did not destroy them, rather he gave them liberation. Such excessive kindness. And not only that, he was very considerate about the souls who are going to be born in the future after his disappearance, who are overwhelmed by lamentation, misery, and illusion due to avidya, ignorance, maya. He had a desire to deliver such souls who are going to appear in the future. And on top of it, he wanted to maintain his reputation, which is glorified by the great sages who composed scriptures, the Smriti scriptures. And therefore, by his own desire to deliver these souls, he took his own dear friend, Srimad Arjuna, put him in the middle of a battlefield, and caused him to experience lamentation and bewilderment. And targeting him, he spoke the purport of the entire Veda, which is broken up into three khandas. So he spoke the Bhagavad Gita, composed of 18 chapters. And he, in that way, he manifested the greatest necessity of all living beings. Tatradhyayanam prathamena shakyena nishkama karma yoga. Among these 18 chapters, the first 6 chapters deal with nishkama karma yoga. Dvitiyena bhakti yoga. By the middle 6 chapters, he presents bhakti yoga. Tritiyena jnana yoga darshita. And in the third 6 chapters, he reveals jnana yoga. Tatrapi bhakti yogasya atirahasyatvam. But nevertheless, even here, because bhakti yoga is most confidential, ubhaya sanjeeva katvena abhyarshitatva, and because it is well known in Vedic scriptures as the one that gives life to karma and jnana. See, the idea is this. Karma has its effect. Like, for instance, if you perform certain pious activities, you go to heavenly planets. That is what the Vedas say. But you should understand that if you do not render Vishnu Bhakti along with that karma, that effect will not come. So it will tell you that, for instance, if you worship such and such a demigod, let us say you want good health, there are certain procedures by which you worship the sun god, Surya. This is obviously karma. It's all within the karma activities, Vedic prescribed material activities. This is called Kamya Karma, optional prescribed activities. So you worship the sun god, but you must also worship Lord Vishnu. If you worship sun god and you do not worship Lord Vishnu, then you will not get any good health. Similarly, there are certain prescribed activities. If you perform them under certain terms and conditions, then you are scheduled to go to the heavenly planets, and you actually go to the heavenly planets, provided you perform those prescribed activities and you follow the terms and conditions. But on top of it, you must engage in bhakti yoga. You must engage in Vishnu bhakti, devotion to Lord Vishnu. If you do not do that, then you will not go to the heavenly planets. Chari varnashrami jadi Krishna nahi bhaje, swadharma korite se raurave poli moje. Chaitanya Mahaprabhu has explained, quoting from Bhagavatam, yesham purusham sakshat atma prabhavam ishwaram na bhajanti avajananti sthanad drashta drashta patankyadaha. If you do not worship the Supreme Personality of Godhead, you go to hell. Even if you perform prescribed activities, the prescribed activities do not give you the fruit. And therefore, bhakti is considered to be the sanjeevaka or the life giver of karma. Similarly, it is stated that if you engage in the Vedic process of jnana, then you can attain liberation, even impersonal liberation. But if you want impersonal liberation, without offending Lord Vishnu, you have to worship Lord Vishnu also. If you, without worshipping Lord Vishnu, if you only do that, then you get nowhere. You get stuck in the material existence. Do not perform devotional service to the Supreme Personality of Godhead. It's a sin by itself. It is an act of omission. Just like in India also, there are, if you, let us say, you're a policeman and you perform your activities very nicely, they give you a gold medal, you get President's Award, you get all these things. However, it is expected that you also pay your income taxes. Suppose you don't pay your taxes and you do some great activity, then they won't give you that medal, because you are committing an act of omission. That is the act of commission, and there is the act of omission. You are not doing what you are meant to do. Similarly, the living entities are supposed to worship Krishna in any of his Vishnu Tattva forms. If you do not do that, and you only do these activities which are prescribed in the Vedas, the promised results will not accrue. So therefore, it is said that the life giver of karma is bhakti, and the life giver of jnana is bhakti. When we say bhakti, we mean Vishnu bhakti, Krishna bhakti, devotion service to any of the Vishnu rupas in a way that satisfies him, as defined in Bhagavatam. That is called bhakti. So, Vishnu Chakravarti also says that the scriptures have stated that both karma and jnana, they get their life from bhakti. Sarva durlabhatvacha madhyavarti krataha. And because bhakti is the most rare commodity to attain, pure bhakti is most rare commodity, therefore bhakti yoga is presented in the middle. Because you may ask, if bhakti is higher than jnana, jnana is higher than karma, why didn't Krishna first in the first six chapters, why did he talk karma? Second six chapters, he could have spoken about jnana. Last six chapters, he would have spoken bhakti. But Krishna Chakravarti explains that the reason why he has put it, he has given three reasons why he is putting it in the middle. The first point is because it is extremely confidential, and therefore you don't just put it out in a way that people can easily get it. Unless you come and get it through sampradaya, you'll never get this point. So purposefully Krishna has made it like that. Just like mantras are put out in various scriptures in a cryptic form, only through a sampradaya acharya he can decipher it and teach you properly. Otherwise it will say it is the 13th letter plus one type of lotus and plus that cloud and that jewel. It will never put out the mantra by itself. But if you know, if you come in a sampradaya of people who know, then they will explain it to you. That is what is called confidential. That technique is adopted in the scripture. Same way, one reason is because bhakti is confidential. Second reason is because bhakti gives life. Bhakti gives life both to karma and to jnana. If you only put it at the end, if you only put bhakti at the end, the last of the, if you put it as the third six chapters, then people may not get the point. They may not get the point that for karma you need bhakti, for jnana you need bhakti. So that's one reason. The third reason is because it is most difficult to attain. So you just put it right in the middle. Karma jnana yor bhakti rahityena vayarthya te dve bhakti mishre eva samadhi krite. Because karma and jnana, even though they are presented in Bhagavad Gita, if you perform karma without mixing it with bhakti, if you perform jnana without mixing it with bhakti, they are useless. And therefore, in the Bhagavad Gita, every time Krishna talks about karma, you perform your prescribed duties. It is obviously understood that you have to perform it along with bhakti. That is understood, that is implicit. Similarly, when Krishna says that jnana is most important, like in some places Krishna will emphasize jnana. He will say, oh, this is the most important thing. In the fourth chapter, in some places, fifth chapter, he will talk like that. But it is understood that when he talks jnana, it is bhakti mishra jnana. Jnana mixed with bhakti. It is not just pure knowledge. That is understood. By context, we understand it. Because otherwise, it is useless. It's like, for instance, if you say that, there was an accident, and this patient is injured, and I was carrying him to the hospital, and then we cured him. So when you say I was carrying him, you're actually carrying his body. It is understood that he was a living body. It is not a dead body. Because by context we understand that you can't take a dead body to hospital, cure him, and then, cure him from a disease. Dead means they're gone. So by context we understand that when I was carrying his body or when I was carrying him, you are carrying him plus the soul. Similarly, whenever you hear in Bhagavad Gita that you perform this prescribed duty in such a way and it will bring you to the mode of goodness, it is understood that you are doing it along with devotional service to Krishna. It is understood. Now the reason why these things are being spelt out by Chakravarti is because from the Bhagavatam perspective, or even from Bhagavad Gita's perspective, these things are not so clear. So he is putting it out right at the beginning. And with this understanding, if you look at Prabhupada's commentary on to Bhagavad Gita, things are very clear. Because everywhere he talks Krishna consciousness. And you may wonder, why is he talking Krishna consciousness everywhere? But Prabhupada is talking to an audience who doesn't understand this point. So every time he is saying, so he is carrying the body along with the soul to the hospital. And then he is curing. All the time he has to say, there's a soul inside it, there's a soul inside it, there's a soul inside it. Because somebody else is coming and saying, you carry the dead body and somehow or other he cured the disease. So Prabhupada has to always make it clear that, no. Krishna consciousness has to be there. Krishna consciousness has to be there. Bhakti is to be vidha. And there are two types of bhakti. Or two levels of performance of bhakti. Okay, let me write this out. This is important. Kevala pradhani bhutastha.
pradhani bhuta.
Kevala means that the person does not do any sinful activities, does not do any karma, does not do any jnana, and is exclusively engaged in 9 types of devotional service to the Supreme Lord. And he does whatever is minimum required to maintain his body and soul together so that he can do bhakti yoga. That is called kevala bhakti. That is called kevala bhakti. Pradhani bhuta means that he gives most of his time to engage in bhakti yoga. Most of his time goes to serving devotees or hearing Bhagavatam, chanting Hare Krishna, spending time reverentially in the holy dham, remembering the Lord or worshipping the deity. Most of his time goes for that. In Kevala, all of his time goes for that. In Pradhani Bhuta Bhakti, most of his time goes for that. He minimizes his material pious activities, his swadharma. That is called Pradhani Bhuta. Kevala Pradhani Bhuta Cha Tatradya Swateva Parama Prabhala. The first type of bhakti by itself is supremely powerful. It's most powerful. It purifies the heart the most. That if you give up every other activity and simply engage in devotional service to the Supreme Lord, you don't bother about your material duties. But you don't commit sinful activities, you don't commit offenses. You only engage in devotional service to the Lord properly, as given by the Acharyas. Swatayeva Parama Prabala is supremely powerful. Te dve karma jnane vinayeva vishuddha prabhavati. And even without karma and jnana, it is spotless in its manifestation of power. It does not require, you don't need to do karma in order to come to the mode of goodness. You don't need to do jnana to understand that material world is miserable. Simply if you engage in kevala bhakti under the guidance of a bona fide spiritual master, then you come to that point. Akinchana ananyadi gardavachya. It is also called akinchana bhakti. It is called ananya bhakti, etc. Dvitiyatu, the second type of bhakti, karma jnana mishretya akhilam agre vibhruti bhavishyati. The second type of bhakti is of further types. There is karma pradhani bhuta bhakti, jnana pradhani bhuta bhakti, karma jnana pradhani bhuta bhakti. That you give a little bit time to karma in your life. Little bit time you give to swadharma. That's called karma pradhani bhuta bhakti. Little bit of time one gives to jnana. Jnana pradhani bhuta bhakti. One does some jnana, but one is primarily engaged in bhakti yoga. Sometimes it is also called karma mishra bhakti, jnana mishra bhakti. So Vishnu Chakravarti says, I'm going to explain all this later in course of the commentary. Later I'll explain. Any questions on that? Otherwise we'll move on to Prabhupada's analysis here.
You mentioned about deliberation, there are 4 types of deliberation. The first one was cross matter, the second one was subtle matter, the third one was the soul. What was the fourth one?
The third one is impersonal. Spiritual but impersonal.
And fourth one
the fourth is complete, which is personal spiritual realization. Complete spiritual realization. Impersonal realization means you are not able to perceive the personality of God, you are only able to perceive His effulgence. Whereas if you are actually able to perceive the Lord, you see both the Brahmajyoti and you see Bhagavan. So it's complete. Okay. In his introduction, the first thing that Prabhupada brings up is, why do we need another edition of Bhagavad Gita? He's saying the Gita is considered to be one of the most important Upanishads. And there are so many commentaries on the Gita in English. And I told you, every year you will find one or two editions coming out. And by Prabhupada's time itself, there were about 500 editions of English Bhagavad Gita. So why do you need another one? And he says that some American lady once asked Prabhupada in America, can you recommend a good translation and a good explanation of Bhagavad Gita? And Prabhupada said, no. Could not find anything which was authoritative. And Prabhupada gives the reason. because in almost every one of them, the commentator has expressed his own opinions without touching the spirit of Bhagavad Gita as it is. He is not dealing with the spirit of Bhagavad Gita. Now, what is the spirit of Bhagavad Gita? What is this concept that Prabhupada often talks about? He has missed the spirit of Bhagavad Gita. The spirit of Bhagavad Gita means the intention of Bhagavad Gita, the internal directions of Bhagavad Gita, the instructions of Bhagavad Gita. And Prabhupada gives the example, when you buy a medicine, you have directions for use that comes along with the medicine. The same person who sells you the medicine sells it to you with a label which is pasted on it. Now they don't sell you an empty bottle without a label. I tell you, if you want, you can take this label. They don't do that. They paste that label on the bottle and they give it to you. It is considered to be one packet. So similarly, Bhagavad Gita doesn't just come as one text and it is almost like a free-for-all. You interpret it the way you like. You can think about it the way you like. Because it is Bhagavad Gita, it is spiritual. Spiritual means you understand from your heart. You read it and it, the meaning will just come. Just like one follower of some impersonalist guru who teaches some yoga or something. He published a book on Sanskrit. And learning Sanskrit. Learn Sanskrit yourself. And then he's teaching basic Sanskrit. And he teaches you how to use a dictionary. And then he says, at the end of the last chapter, so after having read all, after knowing how to use a dictionary, then after some time, then you'll be able to read the Sanskrit text of Bhagavad Gita. So ponder on the Bhagavad Gita by yourself. And look at the Sanskrit words, consult a dictionary and a grammar textbook, and let the various meanings flow in your mind. And just ponder on every meaning that comes to your mind. And let the text reveal itself to you. And in that way you understand the Bhagavad Gita. Because it is all about the absolute. So by thinking about it and by contemplating on the divine, on the immanent spirit, then you begin to understand the Bhagavad Gita gradually by yourself. You don't need to listen to any particular edition of Bhagavad Gita. You just understand it yourself. You just read Sanskrit and understand it. So commonly this is how people think. If you go to any religious bookstore where they sell Indian books on Eastern philosophy, Indian philosophy throughout the world, and you'll find various editions of Bhagavad Gita, this is the idea you get. Just be yourself and you'll understand. But Prabhupada's point is, no, the Bhagavad Gita comes with a label. It comes with a label, comes with an internal set of instructions which are inseparable from that text. It's like a label is pasted onto on a bottle. Similarly, Krishna has pasted a set of instructions. So Prabhupada is saying Bhagavad Gita should be taken or accepted as it is directed by the speaker himself. The speaker of Bhagavad Gita is Lord Shri Krishna. He is mentioned on every page of Bhagavad Gita as the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Bhagavan. So Krishna should be understood and accepted as the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Now, this also you should understand very clearly, because sometimes the word Bhagavan refers to any powerful person. It can refer to great sages, sometimes great kings. But in this context, within the Bhagavad Gita, Bhagavan means the one Supreme Personality of Godhead, the one Supreme God. Vedic literature, at least Bhagavad Gita, is very clearly and explicitly presenting monotheism. There is one Supreme God, who is Krishna or Vishnu. The other Vedic deities are all subordinate to him. The other Vedic deities means anyone other than Vishnu. Shiva, Ganesh, Parvati, Skanda, you name it, Indra, Brahma, they are all under him. They are also real. They are not different forms of Krishna. They are not different forms of Krishna. It is not that you worship this form of Krishna in his Krishna form, and you worship Lord Shiva, and you worship Brahma, and you Shiv Ganesh, they are all different forms of Krishna. They are not different forms of Krishna. They are different beings. They are different beings. They are subordinate to Him. So this point you very clearly understand if you look at Bhagavad Gita. And this is the way Krishna is accepted by all great acharyas. Like Prabhupada says, we should know that Lord Shri Krishna is the Supreme Personality of Godhead, as is confirmed by all great acharyas, spiritual masters like Shankaracharya, Ramanujacharya, Madhvacharya, Nimbarka Swami, Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, and many other authorities of Vedic knowledge in India. This is the way Krishna is accepted. Krishna is accepted the way the Hare Krishna people accept Him. He is one Supreme God. And that is the way great acharyas, like even Shankaracharya. Actually, Shankaracharya never said that Vishnu is equal to the other Vedic deities. That you will not find in Shankara's own writings. These ideas came in the Shankara Sampradaya later. Panchavapasana, the system of worshipping five Vedic deities as being different forms of the one absolute truth. That is a later concept. That is not Shankaracharya's own writings. In his Upanishad commentaries, he accepts that Vishnu is the Supreme. He makes it very clear. So even according to Shankara, what to speak of Ramanuja, Mantuva, Nimbarka, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu and others, they are all very, very clear that Vishnu is Supreme. And the other Vedic deities, they are all subordinate to Him. This is the standard understanding. Then, this is also the very same understanding that comes out in the Gita itself. In the Gita also Krishna says, Mattah Parataram Nanyat. There is no one who is superior to me. Krishna also says that. So the Lord Himself also establishes Himself as the Supreme Personality of Godhead in the Bhagavad Gita. And He is accepted as such in the Brahma Samhita. There is this small booklet called the Brahma Samhita, which we have also published, the BBT is also published. And that is actually the fifth chapter that contains Lord Brahma's description of Krishna's position. And if you go through that, you understand very clearly what is Krishna's position. He is the one Supreme God. He empowers other Vedic deities. He is totally independent. He is non-different from His own expansions known as the Vishnu Tattvas. So all these points come out in Brahma Samhita. So He is accepted as such in the Brahma Samhita and all the Puranas, especially the Srimad Bhagavatam known as Bhagavata Purana. Krishna's Tu Bhagavan Swayam. So Krishna's position as the Supreme Personality of Godhead, as the one Supreme God who is superior to other Vedic deities, is spelled out very, very clearly in the scriptures, in Bhagavad Gita, in the writings of standard authorities of Vedic knowledge in India. This is the way we must accept Krishna's position. So the first point is, when you talk about the spirit of the Bhagavad Gita, it means that we should understand Krishna in this way. Any other understanding of Krishna is going to contradict this spirit. So when we say that all these commentators have expressed their own opinions without touching the spirit of Bhagavad Gita, what does Prabhupada mean by that? It means that they have misrepresented Krishna. They have not presented Krishna as He is. They have misrepresented Krishna. So that is what is meant by saying they have missed the spirit. That is one part of the spirit. The other thing is, we should take Bhagavad Gita as it is directed by the Personality of Godhead Himself. Bhagavad Gita, just as medicine, if it says you take three times two teaspoons a day, that's how you take it. As stated, we take it. Similarly, in the Bhagavad Gita also, Krishna is given a certain direction. This is how you understand it. In fact, Krishna says, the fourth chapter, Imam Vivasvate Yogam Proktavan Aham Avyayam Vivasvan Manave Praham Anurikshva Kave Braveet Evam Parampara Praptam Imam Raja Shriyo Viduhu Sakaleneha Mahata Yogu Nashtah Parantapa Saevayam Mayatevya Yogah Proktah Puratana Bhakto Sime Sakha Cheti Rahasyam Hetu Tamam. Here the Lord informs Arjuna that this system of yoga, the Bhagavad Gita, was first spoken to the sun god. And the sun god explained it to Manu. And Manu explained it to Ikshvaku. And in that way, by disciplic succession, one speaker after another, this yoga system has been coming down. But in the course of time it has become lost. Consequently, the Lord has to speak it again, this time to Arjuna on the battlefield of Kurukshetra. He tells Arjuna that he is relating this supreme secret to him because Arjuna is his devotee and his friend. Why does Prabhupada bring up this point? Because he is going to point out that Arjuna is an eligible student of Bhagavad Gita. Arjuna is an eligible student of Bhagavad Gita. Arjuna has the eligibility to understand Bhagavad Gita. What is his eligibility? His eligibility is here. Bhakto sime sakha cheti rahasyam yetad uttamam. Because you are my devotee and you are my friend, bhaktaha, and my friend sakha, therefore you are eligible to understand Bhagavad Gita. Prabhupada, when he was giving lectures on the Bhagavad Gita, many times he would make this point. Then why did Krishna choose Arjuna out of all these other people to receive Bhagavad Gita? There are so many sannyasis, so many great rishis, so many demigods, so many universal VIPs were there. He could have chosen any one of them as a student for Bhagavad Gita. But instead he chose Arjuna. First of all, Arjuna is not even a Brahmin. Arjuna is not even a Brahmin. Secondly, on top of it, he is a grihastha. He has many, many queens. He is always busy throughout his life fighting someone. And Krishna chose Arjuna to deliver the whole humanity, to save all the sannyasis of the future. He is teaching on grihastha. So why didn't he do that? Because he is a devotee. Bhaktaha. Now, what is this? So what is a devotee? Now, there's a lot of significance between that, this, in that one word, devotee, bhaktaha. Because there are three types of mumukshus, three types of people who try to seek liberation in Vedic civilization. The first, the lowest level, are called jnanis. The jnanis are those who are nirvishesha brahmopasakas. They are those who worship or who meditate on the impersonal Brahman, the impersonal Brahman effulgence of Bhagavan. These are the Nirvishesha Brahmopasakas, the jnanis. But then higher than them are the yogis. The yogi here refers to Paramatma Upasakas, those who meditate on the Paramatma expansion of Bhagavan. The Paramatma expansion of Bhagavan is the super soul form who is present in the hearts of every living being. So these are the yogis who are higher than the jnanis. The yogis, they become conscious of both the impersonal Brahma Jyoti and at the same time they become conscious of the Paramatma feature of the Lord. So they realize two features of the Lord, Brahman and Paramatma features. So they are higher. Higher than them are the devotees. The devotees, when we talk devotee here, we are talking of a pure devotee. He is able to realize Brahman, Paramatma and Bhagavan features of the Lord. And he enters into the Lord's pastimes and he serves the Lord under the instructions of the Lord's associates in the spiritual world. So that is a devotee. Now Arjuna is a devotee. Arjuna is a devotee. Now there are different grades of devotees. There are different grades of devotees. You have different grades of devotees. You have sadhakas. You have the sadhaka. And you have the siddha. Siddha is also called Prapta Swarupa Siddhi, those who attain Swarupa Siddhi, those who attain their Swarup. So you have two levels of bhaktas also. You have the sadhakas and you have the siddhas. The siddhas have attained perfection, they are perfect devotees. The sadhakas are aspiring devotees. We are sadhakas. We are, even though we have as a goal to attain full realization, even though we have as a goal the desire to become fully realized in the Brahman, Paramatma and Bhagavan features of the Lord and become eternal servants of Krishna in the spiritual world, nevertheless, we are sadhakas, we are not siddhas. Now, Arjuna was both a devotee and a friend. Now that friend, that concept of friend is very, very significant, because the siddha devotees, the perfected devotees, they have five types of relationships with the Supreme Lord. And as Prabhupada puts out here, one may be a devotee in a passive state. This is called Shanta Bhakta. One who is absorbed in Shanta Bhakti, Shantaras. One may be a devotee in an active state, Dasyaras. One may be a devotee as a friend, Sakhyaras. One may be a devotee as a parent, Vatsalyaras. One may be a devotee as a conjugal lover, Madhurya Rasa. Each higher rasa contains the elements of the previous rasa. So the idea is, so every soul has its own swarup, like Prabhupada writes. Everyone has a particular relationship with the Lord, and that relationship is evoked by the perfection of devotional service. But in the present status of our life, not only have we forgotten the Supreme Lord, but we have forgotten our eternal relationship with the Lord. Every living being, out of the many, many billions and trillions of living beings, has a particular relationship with the Lord eternally. That is called Swarup. By the process of devotional service, one can revive that Swarup. And that stage is called Swarup Siddhi, perfection of one's constitutional position. So Arjuna, his Swarup was revived. Arjuna was established in his Swarup as a friend. So he was not only a devotee, because when you say that Krishna spoke to a devotee, which devotee? He could have been a sadhaka. No, he spoke to a siddha, a perfected devotee. Spoke to a perfected devotee. Someone who had attained full love of Godhead in one of the bhakti rasas. So he's a perfect devotee. And therefore Krishna spoke Bhagavad Gita to him. Because these are the people who can actually understand Bhagavad Gita. Bhagavad Gita is best understood by someone who has attained pure love of Krishna. It is not really properly understood by anyone who has not attained Krishna Prema. Anyone who is in the lower stages of devotion service, they cannot understand it. So even though it is said that Bhagavad Gita is a textbook for neophytes, it can be fully and properly grasped only by someone on the status of Arjuna. The others will not be able to grasp it. Okay, I'll stop with this and I'll deal with other points tomorrow. Any questions? I don't think we have much
time.
Yes.
Now there is a second edition published by BBD.
BBD?
Yeah. Are there any significant differences between the first and second edition?
The second edition is closer to Prabhupada's dictation, because what they did was they transcribed Prabhupada's dictation and they checked the first edition with that.
So that was the first edition.
Tell me? It's the second edition.
You call it second edition?
It is the second edition. Second edition. Look, a note about second edition. Second edition.
Okay.
Second edition. You can have various imprints.
Yeah.
But it's the second edition.
Okay.
The second edition. Minor corrections come in the form of imprints.
Right. Because you know why I was confused about this? Because in the temple I saw an edition. It said on the front, it's second edition. But this one doesn't say the front is second edition.
No, it says completely
yeah.
Revised. It's the same. This is another imprint. So to make things more clear, they changed it.
Yeah.
Minor corrections are usually put out by publishing houses through imprints. Major corrections are put out in the form of editions. So that's a major correction for any book. They will make third edition, fourth edition. But if minor corrections, they just reprint. It will be second imprint or third imprint. So there are some changes, but they are very, very minor. Very minor.
So this is all right.
This is the one that I am using. Okay, we'll stop with this. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare.